Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back, Critic listeners. Can the West live without China? Would decoupling from China inflict greater damage to the American and British economies than it would hurt China? Graham Stewart talks to Stuart Patterson about whether disengagement is an act of self-harm or a sensible stitch in time. Stuart Patterson is a former chief Asian equity strategist for Credit Suisse in Hong Kong, and more recently, author of China, Trade and Power, Why the West's Economic Engagement Has Failed.
Can the West live without China? To help me discuss this question, I'm talking now to Stuart Patterson, research fellow at the Heinrich Foundation. Stuart, you're the author of China, Trade and Power, Why the West's Economic Engagement Has Failed, which is a book I read about a year ago and strongly influenced my thinking about the position of China in the world economy and how other economies should relate to it. You've had a past as an investment manager in India, Singapore and Hong Kong, and were chief Asian equity strategist at Credit Suisse. First of all, you have argued that it was a historic mistake in 2001 for China to be admitted to the World Trade Organization, the WTO. Why is that?
It was really a function of several things. Firstly, the terms on which China was admitted. There were a few flaws in this. It was demonstrable already that China was pursuing a sort of mercantilist approach to trade and economic growth. What the accession facilitated was an extremely rapid expansion of China's export machine and growth in manufacturing prowess, without putting in place the natural mechanisms, particularly currency flexibility, a liberalization of the capital account and a privatization of the banking system, that would have allowed China to engage with the rest of the world and trade with the rest of the world on a scale, but for there to be symmetry in the economic relationship. The second mistake was really one of intent. The West, in engaging with China and allowing accession to WTO, was under the belief that deeper economic engagement would produce prosperity in China. They got that bit right, but that prosperity would inevitably lead to a convergence of political norms and economic norms, and that China would liberalize to become a market economy, and would ultimately move along the path to democracy, and would become a responsible stakeholder in the global order. And while at various times since secession there have been periods of optimism, really when Xi Jinping came to power initially, and then obviously with the changes to the constitution to allow him to remain in power indefinitely, it's become increasingly clear that far from instigating a liberalization process, economic engagement with China by generating wealth has actually enhanced the incentives for the CCP to maintain their grip on power. And also the party now bask in the reflective glory of China's economic success, which has enabled them, if you like, to fulfill their side of the social contract with the people, which is that you leave us to govern and we will ensure that you get richer.
Stuart, let me just pick you up on that there. Let's accept that the West hubristically imagined that China's greater engagement with Western capitalism would make it a more liberal democracy or any kind of liberal democracy, and whereas in fact it's made China richer and has therefore made the Chinese Communist Party stronger. Let's accept that at that political level the West made a misjudgment. Nevertheless, economically, has this been such a bad engagement for the West? One thinks of the flow of cheap goods that have come in, the effect of lower inflation worldwide. We've had that period of the so-called Great Moderation. This period of low inflation and low borrowing costs has surely been dramatically successful in making the West ever more of a consumer society.
Well, I would disagree with that. First of all, it's indisputable that China was a big exporter of deflation. That could potentially have been to the benefit of US and Western consumers generally. What has happened has been that you have had a bifurcation of inflation. So traded goods, things like white goods, televisions, electronics, and what have you, have become much more affordable. They've become much more cheaper. Those prices have been set in a sort of hyper-globalized world, and they reflect Chinese costs of production. Now, that should have been a big boon to Western consumers. However, when you combine it with a policy of inflation targeting by Western central banks, that benefit has been taken away. And let me explain why. What has happened is that Western central bank monetary policy has all been about ensuring that the overall price level rises at about 2% per annum, year in, year out. So clearly, if the price of tradable goods is going to fall dramatically as a result of globalization, the price of other things has to go up in order for them to meet that target. And if you had said at the beginning of 2000 that, you know, the Federal Reserve would run real interest rates at minus 0.75% for 20 years and quintuple the size of its balance sheet and yet still miss the inflation target, you would have been laughed out of court as being some kind of lunatic. It sounded like a recipe for hyperinflation. What we've had, of course, is very meaningful inflation in things like financial asset prices, property prices, education costs, transportation costs, all the non-tradable sectors of the economy. So my point here is the benefits of cheap Chinese goods have been taken away from the average consumer who pays less for those but more for other things, and passed on to the people who benefited from very easy monetary policy, low interest rates and quantitative easing, which has largely been the older generation who had property to begin with, or they had significant financial savings beforehand, and those people who have made a living out of jobbing those assets in one form or another. And so what it has produced has been a very lopsided economy in the West, where we've sacrificed our manufacturing capabilities and made ourselves incredibly reliant on external countries for the provision of basic pharmaceuticals, for example. Those people involved in the service side and the asset side of the economy have done very well. And clearly this has produced some very unequal outcomes and is the source of a lot of the social and political tensions that I think we see in our society today. The other point I would make just from China's point of view is, of course, they were pushing on an open door here. I'm not blaming them per se. They pursued mercantilist policies. We failed in the West to spot that that was going to be the case, which was perhaps inexcusable. We failed to push back on it and use the multilateral organizations that exist for dealing with this. We failed to use them properly, and maybe they were not designed to cope with such a mercantilist power and therefore didn't necessarily have the ability to do so. But letting a country of China's potential size into the global trading system at a 30th of prevailing cost, in my view, was bound to have very negative ramifications.
Well, we can't wind back history. So we now find ourselves asking this question. We're addicted to the China drug. Is the pain of weaning ourselves off greater than we're prepared to bear?
It is. I mean, obviously, what we need is here an economic cost-benefit of analysis of a certain amount of dialing back of the relationship with China. But that also needs to be weighed up against other potential costs and benefits of not doing it. So If we turn to manufacturing, which is obviously where China's demonstrated extraordinary prowess, largely because of its scale and government-led industrial policy, which obviously in a one-party state can be all-encompassing. At the time of recession, China had about a 6% share in global manufacturing. That's now 28% or so. So it's been rising, you know, at more than a percentage point per annum. That trend simply cannot be allowed to continue because the impact of that is to hand to the Communist Party of China enormous political and geopolitical leverage over their client states, as we've seen in the case of 5G and also sort of COVID-related trade. And so the cost of doing nothing in terms of handing this sort of monopolistic or allowing this monopolistic grip on manufacturing to be procured by a totalitarian state is clearly very high. The financial costs of military containment would be very high as well. And, you know, it's worth remembering that, you know, since the end of the Cold War, there has been an enormous peace dividend. And, you know, you only have to look at China's nine dash line in the South China Sea or what's going on at the moment on the Indian-Chinese border to see that, you know, the rejuvenation of China, as Xi Jinping would put it, comes at the expense, to some extent at least, of other people. And therefore, China's ability to inflict a heavy cost on the West is very real.
I want to turn to the issue of Chimerica, which is a phrase which has been popularized by Professor Neil Ferguson. This is the Neil Ferguson, the historian, not Neil Ferguson, Professor Lockdown, just to be clear. And this Chimerica, it creates the notion of a codependence between particularly America, but the West in general, and China, in which China produces goods, finds a massive export market in America and the West. In doing so, the goods are bought there. China earns large currency reserves, which in turn it reinvests in US government securities, which is government debt in essence, and that keeps interest rates low. Given how indebted Western countries are, surely it's in our interests to keep the cost of borrowing incredibly low. If China sells, aren't we in the course of an economic disruption, aren't we all going to lose out?
Well, I would describe the relationship as being more of a parasite than a sort of codependency, in the sense that China has clearly run perennial current account surpluses throughout its period of economic engagement, and that's largely down to the asymmetry of market access and the state sort of suppression of domestic demand as part of a sort of a nationalistic approach to economic building. And you know, those foreign exchange reserves were perceived as sort of treasure, if you like. In the early stages, they were required to give backing to the RMB to instill confidence in it. Even though those foreign exchange reserves have declined somewhat from 4 trillion to 3 trillion, it's worth noting that that took place against a backdrop of Chinese state-owned enterprises acquiring a similarly large dollar-denominated number of overseas assets. In other words, it was more of an asset swap from the central bank to SOEs. But there was some capital flight from China, and that highlights another element to the relationship in the sense that, you know, in a free market, the exchange rate should reflect the economic fundamentals. But the capital flight from China was really down to some of China's elite removing capital from China in an attempt to get it away from the CPC. Now, you know, when you're that you get that sort of interaction of politics and economics, then clearly the key that, you know, what was the most important price and potentially still is the most important price in the world, the US RMB exchange rate, it was clearly always going to be a manipulated one and one that didn't reflect necessarily the economic realities and the adjustment process. Can China sell its treasuries and would that raise borrowing costs in the United States? Well, the question, I think the answer is no, actually. When you sell your treasuries, you end up with a US dollar denominated deposit, which will yield you precisely nothing. If you're going to sell that US dollar deposit and put it into another currency, you have to sell the dollar. And buy what exactly? Are you going to repatriate it and bring it back to your own currency? Well, if you do, you're going to drive the value of the RMB up and the value of the dollar down. And that's precisely what is required, in fact, to rebalance the relationship. So that sort of geoeconomic tool from China would actually help redress the trade imbalances that have existed. And is not necessarily what China wants. In terms of driving borrowing costs up, I think the reality is that the West has become so indebted that the only way we are going to be able to get ourselves out of this debt hole is through a period of inflation anyway. That this debt will have to be inflated away over a period of time. It's what has happened every time debt has reached these kind of gargantuan summits. Therefore, the short answer is the Federal Reserve will be stepping in to buy this government debt that the Chinese may or may not sell, because the Americans and other countries will be desperate to generate inflation and create a sort of period of financial repression where savers are earning negative real interest rates in order to inflate this debt away. So I'm unconvinced that Chinese holdings of US debt are the geoeconomic weapon that perhaps some people think they are.
But you are suggesting, nevertheless, that a decoupling between, an economic decoupling between China and the West would probably result in higher inflation. But you're just saying that actually that has a number of important benefits given the amount of debt that's been accumulated.
I mean, central banks have been desperate to generate inflation for the last 10 years and have singularly failed to meet their targets. It would also be a more balanced inflation, if you like, because, you know, clearly some of the phenomena that I've described earlier, such as the dramatic rise in asset prices, which have benefited one generation at the expense of the other. One would expect asset prices to deflate. One would expect the prices of manufacturing goods to rise somewhat. But there would be a sort of rebalancing within the economy as a result.
One of the great issues for any decoupling is the extent to which the West's engagement with China, particularly in regard to supply chains, can be untangled. These supply chains have been created not by government diktat, but by what the market determines to be the most efficient means of supplying goods at a competitive price. Surely any breaking up of the supply chain, any rerouting it to other countries, in the short to medium term, involves considerable higher costs, economic dislocation, and all the lower growth that comes with that.
Well, I think you're right and you're wrong. I think that, firstly, it was a certain amount of government diktat that created these supply chains. You know, China's industrial policy throughout the last 20 years has been aimed at bringing manufacturing into China. Subsidies, export rebates, etc., have played a very large part in China's rapid ascent through the ranks of manufacturing powers. But you were very right to say that disentangling these supply chains from China will A, take time, and B, incur costs. But I think what COVID has taught us is that there is a trade-off between efficiency and resilience, and that an over-dependence on one source of supply comes with unforeseen costs down the road. What I am not arguing that we will see is a wholesale departure from China of Western multinationals, or for that matter, Chinese companies, and the sort of wholesale shifting of manufacturing to other destinations. But what I do think we will see is some of that manufacturing moving offshore, and that was a trend that has been in place, driven by market forces for the last couple of years because of rising costs, because of the tariffs, because of the arbitrary nature in which MNCs have been treated by China. Robotics will play a part. The desire, as part of an environmental agenda, to shorten supply chains is there. The consumer too is leading this, in the sense that consumers have become much more aware of China's human rights record, of its environmental record, slightly pushing back on Chinese-made goods. So there are many different factors other than a political desire to see some dialing back of the West's engagement with China that were already strongly pointing towards the need to move some out of China. And incremental investment, I think, rather than necessarily unraveling of existing investment, will have a disproportionately large propensity to flow to other areas of the world. And, you know, it's often said that there's no country that can produce the scale that China does. And of course, there's some truth in that. But, you know, you would have said the same thing in terms about the lack of infrastructure and what have you back in the early 1990s when China was kicking off. I expect that there will be a very large number of companies that at the margin will take market share from China. And apart from anything else, this is going to be driven by demographics as well, because what we've seen during China's ascent is a working age population that's expanded from about 600 million to a billion. And over the next 30 years, that will unravel and China's working age population will shrink by about a third. All the growth in working age population will take place really in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, i.e. the Indian subcontinent. And that is where I see incremental investment being channeled going forward on a cost advantage basis also because that is where the growth will be.
If we are looking to Africa and India as replacements for China, I mean, a lot of these countries aren't there yet. If this process of disengagement from China is a 5, 10 or 15 year process, then that could be managed quite naturally. If, as a series of political crises, Hong Kong, Taiwan and so on, we find ourselves disengaging very sharply on a 12 to 24 month view, these other markets simply are not in a position to replicate at scale.
So I think I differentiate here somewhat between areas of economic activity that are critical to our national infrastructure and those areas of economic activity that are not. And clearly, I think the sense of urgency is to ensure that Western economies are not dependent on Chinese suppliers for areas of critical national infrastructure. In terms of the longer term trend, it is simply not in China's interests to cut off their own exports to the West. They need those dollars for their own program of national aggrandizement. So what I think has changed as a result of Trump's trade war, but more importantly, just a general growing awareness of the degree to which China has put itself in a position to assert economic power and what they might be prepared to do with it. That growing awareness, I think, means that there's been a crucial change. The time is now really our friend rather than time is China's friend, because until that moment, China seemed to be on this inextricable sort of rise, And now, if you like, the clock is ticking in terms of our ability to decouple gradually over the next decade or so, while they, in a way, are slightly helpless there because they don't want to accelerate that process, and they don't necessarily want to do anything to accelerate that process.
Logic suggests you're right. It would be self-defeating for them to bring things to a rapid crisis. However, they're not governed by logic. They're governed by Xi Jinping. And already Australia finds itself facing massive tariffs for having the supposed temerity to demand an inquiry, an international inquiry into China's handling of coronavirus. Heaven forfend how, in other ways, we might offend China, in which case they may take action which is economically self-harming to them and incidentally possibly to us as well, but they will do so for political reasons. So I'm just really trying to get a sense of if this should happen, if there's a hard breakup rather than a soft breakup, how damaging this would be to a country like the UK.
So I mean, the macro numbers suggest that it's manageable at the top down level. So I mean, the UK. China accounts for about 3.5% of UK exports, for example, and we import about 7% of our imports come from China. The crucial areas, of course, are telecom equipment and computers. But they aren't the only source of those, but they are important, and you know, this is the price we pay for having allowed this situation to develop. To put it in perspective, US-China trade is actually just slightly smaller than EU-UK trade. So again, it is perfectly manageable. And you know, the asymmetry of the relationship between the West and China in trade is what makes it difficult for China's lead. Now, you mentioned the barley tariffs, obviously, which will impact perhaps the price of beer in China, but it's noticeable that they didn't put tariffs on iron ore, for example, which would impact their industrial military complex. So my sense is that China needs the rest of the world very much more than the rest of the world needs China, and that as time goes on, that will be even more true as we tackle the pinch points that China has created in places like telecom equipment, rare earths, for example, and make sure that we aren't beholden to China for strategically important components within our critical national infrastructure.
I'm very struck by how rapidly the position of a country like the UK has changed towards China. Only a few years ago, George Osborne was rolling over and making clear that Britain wanted to be China's number one pal. After he ceased to be in Downing Street, David Cameron got himself a job trying to encourage British investment in the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. I suspect it wasn't going very well for him before now, and maybe going rather worse now. But also Brexiteers, they were saying, you know, we're wonderful, Britain as a sovereign nation will be able to make its own trade agreements. The huge market of China is waiting for Britain. We'll do a deal with China. That's totally off the table now, isn't it? Things have changed very rapidly, but they've changed rapidly because of political considerations, and I'm including coronavirus and fears about a Huawei in that. In essence, the entire economic reality is being transformed because of a very short period of time of changing political will. Is that a fair analysis?
I think it is. And I think some of the cuddling up to China was very naive and very misplaced. The myth of the China market as being the panacea to all our problems. When you look at what China does import, you know, the vast majority of its imports are simply related to its export machine and its strategic necessities. So, you know, a quarter of its imports are either fuels, oil and gas, or ores that go into steel and various metals, for example. Well, the UK isn't in a great position as a net energy importer ourselves, and we're not blessed with massive deposits of easy to access iron ore anyway. So, you know, we're not in a position particularly to exploit that. The capital goods side of things, yes, there have been specific UK companies that have done well. But, you know, Made in China 2025, which is China's restated industrial policy, moving up the value-added curve into robotics and AI and what have you, is all about ensuring self-dependence, self-reliance in China on these higher value-added things that Germany in particular and Japan to a lesser extent have been successful in exporting to them. So the decoupling in many ways is being led by China, not by Trump. You know, it doesn't surprise, I mean, I have been surprised by the speed with which it's happened. But the big, you know, China's the great big market and hope of the future was in my view always a bit of a myth.
Well, Stuart Patterson, author of China, Trade and Power, Why the West's Economic Engagement Has Failed. We'll return to this theme, I know, another time, because it's one that's going to run and run. But thank you very much for your insight.
Thank you, Greg.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic Podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.